Good morning. I preached this sermon once already today, and I preached it so badly that as I was walking back down here, I thought, I've got to change that and fiddle it around a bit. So, Rosa, I apologise. The last couple of pages, I might not follow the script exactly as I've given it to you, but the pictures will remain the same. Okay, one of the unusual things in the Bible is the amount of narrative. 25% of the Bible is teaching, then there's quite a bit of poetry, but 43% of the Bible is narrative. Now, that's quite unusual for a holy book. And the thing about narrative is that it doesn't explicitly tell you what it's trying to say to you. So you have to engage with it and find points of connection. And sometimes some people get one thing out of a narrative, sometimes people get other things. You recognize that it was written at a different time, different context, and therefore, as you interpret, you have to use a little bit of care. So that's just by way of preamble that we're looking at narrative over these coming weeks. And we're going to be looking at the narratives of the book of Daniel. First six chapters are a narrative. And Daniel's story is located around the time when a large chunk of the Jewish population were yanked away from Jerusalem and taken into exile. I think we want the picture before that, Rosa, if you've got it still. No? Okay. Oh, leave it there. That's it, yeah. That's a picture of destruction of Jerusalem. All of this happened about 600 years before the coming of Jesus. And the exile happened in stages, and Daniel was one of the early deportees. I think there was a fear in those days that if you left too many young blokes in the city, they might start an uprising. So it wasn't uncommon to take young men away, and that future generation that might change things wasn't there anymore. Anyway, they were relocated over in Babylon. Ancient city, you've heard of it before, the Tower of Babel, Babylon, Baghdad. It comes up time and time again through history. Now, next slide. Daniel was one of several gifted and capable young men from an aristocratic background who were handpicked to serve the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. We're never told exactly what they did or what particular skill sets they had, but Daniel keeps cropping up at significant moments in the nation's life, and throughout all of it, he remains faithful to God. And so, as I reflect on this, I want to reflect on a theme of faith away from home. He keeps his faith in a very alien, foreign environment. Now, that came home to me years and years ago, back in the 1980s. I was living in Leicester at the time, and my father was a Watford supporter. I grew up in Reading, so I've always had an affection for Reading and Watford, who, by the way, won 6-2 yesterday away from home, in case you hadn't noticed that in the results. But maybe it's all starting again. But back in those heady days of the 1980s, John Barnes was a 17-year-old playing for Watford. We had Luther Blissett, some of the big names that played for England later on. And they were a reasonable team. And the guys at the church said to me, Leicester are playing against Watford. That's your team, isn't it? Why don't you come and watch the game? And so foolishly I did, because I didn't give a lot of thought to where the fans position themselves. You see, you have one set of fans at one end, and then the Leicester fans were down this end, and I was mixed in with the Leicester fans. Now, unfortunately, Watford scored the first goal. You would think fortunately, because I was just about to go, yeah, and then I thought, no, maybe not. Maybe not. In fact, there was a sort of a lot of booing and antagonism towards Watford coming from all around me. And so I kept my head down, didn't cheer, just inside I thought, what a good goal, and I am so happy, Lord, that Watford are in front. Leicester proceeded to score four goals. Gary Lineker, I think, was playing at the time and scored two of them, and that was that. We got hammered 4-1 in the end. Faith away from home, it's quite difficult sometimes. And being a person of faith in church is easy enough. But when you're in an alien environment, perhaps even a hostile one, then faithfulness is not a given. It takes courage to stand up for what you believe. And this chapter raises difficult questions. I coined it earlier as compromise, but maybe it's more about being constructively critical, but nonetheless looking to take a stand. Now, many of you will be familiar with Daniel 1 to 6, if we can have, thank you. But less familiar with Daniel 7 to 12. Broadly speaking, what you've got is six chapters of narrative followed by six chapters of curious visions, which Jesus picks up again in Mark 13 and Matthew 24 and Luke 21. What you may not know is that the book is in two languages, Aramaic and Hebrew, and they do not divide up tidally, as you can see in that diagram. You would have thought one language would be 1 to 6 and the other 7 to 12, but it's not quite like that. So something else is going on in the head of the author as he pieces this together. And if you explore that in more depth, that can be quite interesting. But it's one of those things that's not absolutely clear. Those who study these things in depth reckon that this book was actually published around the 160s BC, so about 400 years after Daniel actually lived. And at that time, the Jews were being attacked by a Greek king called Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who wanted to suppress Judaism. Can we take the next slide? And other religions, and impose Greek culture on everyone. In the event, there was a resistance movement led by Judas Maccabeus, which thwarted his plan. But the visions in Daniel 7 to 12 use grotesque imagery, and as you try and interpret it, Christians take different lines on what they actually refer to. Is it a reference to Antiochus Epiphanes, or is it a reference to some future Roman emperor, or maybe some person who lies in our future? Nobody's quite sure. But what unites the book is this concern with keeping the faith in a hostile, alien environment, faith away from home. So the lives of Daniel and his three friends are in many ways a fulfillment of Jeremiah's instruction to God's people. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce, marry and have sons and daughters, increase in number there, do not decrease. Also seek the prosperity of the city into which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it. And then notice, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. So I want to reflect on this idea of constructive criticism. Not shying away from things, but getting involved and being constructive. So let's get into Daniel chapter 1. Deducing from this story that God wants us all to become vegetarians may not be its enduring or even correct relevance. Some of you will be relieved to know that. I certainly will. For one thing, we don't actually know exactly why Daniel and his friends took the view that they did. Was it that they understood the connection between fatty meat and high cholesterol? It's funny, isn't it? At the end of it, having eaten vegetables, they're fatter than the blokes presumably who ate the meat, which doesn't work out in my experience. But anyway, that's another issue. Or was it that pork was on the menu, which was, of course, an unclean food for Jews? Or was it that the king's food was routinely presented to the Babylonian gods before it was consumed, thereby making it unclean by association? You go to the New Testament, there's all sorts of arguing over this, about food offered to idols in 1 Corinthians 8 and Romans 14. Some Christians felt it had been contaminated by that offering and therefore refused to eat it. Other Christians said that the Roman gods don't even exist and therefore the sacrifice has absolutely no meaning and therefore they'll quite happily buy that stuff from the market. Life in Babylon was not life as Daniel and his friends had lived it in Jerusalem, and so presumably some compromises had to be made. But on this issue of food from the king's table, whatever that specific issue was, they drew a line. And it begs the question for us, where do we draw our lines? Now, this is where interpretation gets difficult. For example, Jesus actually spoke against the obsession with avoiding certain foods. And in Matthew 15, he says that it's not what goes into your mouth that defiles you, it's what comes out of it. All that gossip, that abuse, foul language. Peter's vision in Acts 10 of God telling him to eat unclean food was an unsettling but also defining moment for the first Jewish Christians, and something which distinguished them from the other Jews. So let me explore that a little bit further, and maybe explore it first of all by reflecting on one of the issues which our country faces today. Now, thinking about this cross-cultural thing and the movement of populations, non-democratic countries are less tolerant of other religions, so that you can practice your Christian faith privately in Saudi Arabia, but you mustn't evangelize, and to be a citizen, you must convert to Islam. Of increasing concern is the way that women's rights are being curtailed in countries like Afghanistan and Iran, which is where most of our refugees are coming from these days. Here in the UK, we've wanted to be a multicultural society, and we've wanted to be welcoming to different cultures. But there is a feeling among many, and I'm wanting to acknowledge this, that we're the ones making the compromises, and that newcomers are not making a big enough effort to fit in. We have an old saying, you know, when in Rome, live like the Romans. So one obvious point of connection for us is this broader debate about the future of British culture, people who come in with different convictions to our own. Is it possible to have a multicultural society, or is it a recipe for further division and hostility? Should other religions be allowed to come here and exercise their faith? We might applaud such faithfulness in Daniel, but remember, he was somebody who came into that culture. What about people here who have come in to this culture, who have different persuasions to us and principles over which they are not prepared to compromise? And sometimes, and I think they make the legitimate criticism, that the West isn't perfect. We've become very decadent in so many ways, and perhaps they can make improvements to how we are. Now, France has taken quite a hard line on this, as you probably know, so that Muslim girls are not permitted to wear head coverings at school, but their tensions are compounded by their history. And so if you go back to the Bataclan theatre massacre in 2015, in which 90 people were gunned down, you look at it more closely, you discover that the terrorists were Moroccans and Algerians. And then if you look at the history of Morocco and Algeria, you discover they were protectorates of France. And there are these lingering aggravations and feelings that people have. More recently, during the Conservative leadership campaign, won yesterday by Kemi Badenoch, she was quizzed on this by Laura Koonsberg a few Sundays back, and she welcomed the diversity of cuisine on offer, don't we all, in multicultural Britain, but insisted that people coming here must buy into our democratic and Western values. And the one that she particularly homed in on was equal rights for women. So that debate is going to roll on, but it's important for us to engage with it, not say we're the church, we don't want to have anything to do with that. These are important things for our national life. And I suspect that we need to find a middle ground between, on the one hand, what some call a siege mentality, where we feel this threat is going to take over and we're going to lose everything as a nation, and on the other, a naive, laissez-faire attitude, which kind of naively says, oh, everything will be all right, let's just be laid back about this. Make no mistake, the issues are very real for a lot of people in this country, and the future of British culture deserves a very careful, measured debate in which Christians have a real duty to play their part. Now, Rosa, I might wander off script a bit here, so you're just going to have to use your imagination about when to come in. All right. It seems to me that in this whole area of constructive criticism, there are negative ways to go and positive ways to go. Let me just start with the positive thing, but backtrack a little bit. It seems to me that Christians are so often in a negative mindset within society. If you're following the American election at the moment, you'll know that Donald Trump has kind of pitched in with the anti-abortionists, and that has become a huge issue within the evangelical church out there, Roe v. Wade and all of that. And they reckon that if Kamala Harris actually wins the election, she'll have to give a big acknowledgement to women giving her their vote in the election. It's just interesting how that abortion issue has become absolutely massive over in America. We have different debates over here. That picture there, if you could go back 200 years, you would find that the big debate within churches was a very in debate. Back in those days, church attendance was absolutely huge. If you go to 1851, they did a census, and 54% of the adult population of England and Wales were in church. By 1900, it had dropped to 25%. I'm not sure if it's much over 5% now. So it was a different kind of context 200 years ago, but they were arguing about the Bible, and they were using words like infallibility and inerrancy, and there was a new liberal tradition coming out which was more critical of the text and so on. So that was a real, real battleground that was going on back in those days. One of the depressing things I've been reading a little bit recently about the Russian Revolution, which sort of started in 1917 and led to a civil war in Russia over the next 6 years, in which 10 million people died. But on the day that it kicked off, the Russian Orthodox Church was in solemn assembly discussing what vestments they should wear during worship. I mean, how irrelevant is that? Sometimes the stuff that we're really concerned about is not really engaging with what's going on around us. I remember in the 1960s, as I was growing up, creation versus evolution was a huge kind of debate that was going on, and the role of women in the church. Oh, that's been a big one, hasn't it? I grew up in the Brethren during communion one Sunday. This is my one enduring memory of being in the Brethren. During communion one Sunday morning, suddenly something kicked off behind. I wasn't really aware until afterwards what had happened. There were a group of students from Reading University that had come in. The girls had come in not wearing hats, which you had to do in the Brethren. If you were a woman, you had to wear a hat in church back in the 1960s. And she hadn't worn her hat. And when the bread came round, and in our tradition in the Brethren, it used to get passed along the rows from the back to the front, came past her, she took the bread and ate it. A woman, an elderly woman in the church wearing a hat, turned around and saw her do this and was horrified. And when the wine came, she physically tried to prevent her from drinking the wine. The student screamed and cried and left, and all her friends went out with her. And a load of us wondered what had gone on, and then gradually over the coming weeks we found out what the issue was. Isn't that amazing? I mean, I can't imagine that happening today. We had the priesting of women in the 1990s, and times have changed. What I'm trying to say to you is that sometimes when we take a stand on things, it's a very negative kind of thing. And it seems to me that in this passage, there's a very constructive way in which Daniel goes forward. He says, look, give us a trial run for 10 days. See if we're not healthier at the end of it. And of course, the end of the story is that they are so much healthier. And it echoes what Jeremiah had said in his prophecy that we looked at earlier. Seek the good of the city. If it prospers, you will prosper. There was a positivity about that. Now, I think I had a taste of that some years ago. We were in East London, in a church in East London, and in a largely Muslim area. Now, one of our members, who was our parish nurse, was also a practice nurse in the local surgery, and she was concerned that a lot of the Muslim women who were coming to her were in a very unhealthy state. Part of it was to do, I think, with aspects of their diet, but part of it was the fact that they couldn't go anywhere and exercise, because to exercise properly, you needed to remove your veil, and if there were men present, you couldn't do that, and so there was nowhere to go. And so Noreen, bless her, said, why don't we as a church set up an exercise group for women, and I will, from the practice, start redirecting women along to the church. We will have a bespoke space, men not allowed in at all. They can unveil, there'll be other women there as well, not just Muslim women, but they can have their bespoke private space where they can exercise. And that went on for a number of years. In fact, over 10 years by the time that we left, it was still actually going. And it struck me at the time that it was a constructive way forward. It would have been so easy for us as Christians to point the finger and say, oh, we don't agree with that, and you've got so many rituals that you're always complying with, and where's the ethics, and oh, we could have done so many things to take a stand. And yet this was something constructive that actually, I think, gave the church a good name in an area which was predominantly Muslim. So there is that kind of positive way of going forward. And it was a small thing, I know, but hopefully a positive gesture on our part. But then I want to take it negatively, which is a funny way to take this. And I want to talk about the way in which we need to look at things that we won't take a stand on. And the interesting thing is that the way some of us do it is to point the view at issues, point the finger at issues out there or other people out there. And rather than do that, there's a strong tradition within Christianity to point the finger at myself and say, what is it that I will not compromise on in my own life? The old serenity prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's a great prayer. It's a big prayer. But actually, one of the things I can change is myself. Actually, not tolerating those things in my own life that we can definitely do something about. It's easy enough to point out the speck in somebody else's eye and to ignore the log in my own eye. But those are the things that we ought to address. And so in 590 AD, you may remember that Pope Gregory the First came up with a list of seven deadly sins. There they are in front of you. And the corresponding cardinal virtues. Take a good look at those. Take a look at those virtues in particular. How would you score yourself out of those things? Generosity, hard work, humility, patience, contentment, love, moderation. Interesting, isn't it? I tried to write the kind of seven deadly sins of the modern era, and they come up as a very different list of things. It's not a real tackling of yourself and making yourself a better person. Now, at the heart of Christianity is a cross. Jesus, the sacrificial lamb without spot or blemish, but also the one who stood up to the powers, stood for the truth. And that blend of the fact that he actually had tackled the temptations in his own life, but also was prepared to stand up for those who were poor and to stand against those who were corrupting the truth. Christian orthodoxy teaches that the power of Jesus' death rested both upon the purity of his extraordinary life and the outspoken courage he displayed. So a final image for you. This is Yad Vashem. It's a 44.5-acre site in Jerusalem which commemorates the Holocaust. During the war, upward of 60 million people, the Second World War, upward of 60 million people died, 6 million Jews in the death camps of Nazi Germany. And there's that memorial that you saw in the first picture, but also an avenue of trees outside. And it's an avenue of trees commemorating Gentiles who showed courage and did something constructive during those awful years of Nazism. And each tree represents a non-Jew, a Gentile, who courageously stood up for what they felt to be true. And so Daniel starts the ball rolling, standing up for what he believes he needs to stand up for. And that story develops in different ways as we go forward. So may we engage with the issues of our day, and may we discern the guidance of God as we seek to make our stand in this, our generation. And may our lives reflect both the power and integrity of Jesus' life. Amen.